From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, an actor who has great legs and isn't afraid to use them. We talk with Charles Bush about why dressing in drag freed him as an actor. He writes and stars in Hollywood send-ups like Psycho Beach Party. His Vampire Lesbians of Sodom was Off-Broadway's longest-running hit. Now he plays Morticia's Countess Cousin in Addams Family Values. The screenplay for Addams Family Values was written by our second guest, Paul Rudnick. He also wrote the Off-Broadway hit Jeffrey, a comedy about love in the age of AIDS. Bette Midler is starring in a new production of Gypsy that will be broadcast on TV Sunday night. David Bianculli has a review. And Stephen Schiff has a review of the new film Geronimo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Warren Christopher concluded his latest series of Middle East shuttle trips today with a visit to PLO headquarters in Tunis. The secretary carried a letter from Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin inviting PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat to a meeting to discuss implementation of the Palestinian self-rule agreement. Arafat immediately agreed to the summit, which is scheduled for Sunday. The meeting comes one day before Israel has agreed to start withdrawing its troops from the occupied territories. Rabin has said that the withdrawal may have to be delayed because of an upsurge in violence since the agreement was signed in September. Six Air National Guard members died in Milwaukee today when a plane they were working on exploded on an airport runway. Chuck Quernbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
The six men had reportedly been doing routine maintenance on a Wisconsin National Guard refueling plane. After about 15 minutes of work, there was an explosion and fire, and the men were apparently killed instantly. The plane was still carrying about 4,500 gallons of aviation fuel. Base Commander Eugene Schmitz says it's standard practice in military and commercial aviation to leave fuel in a plane while servicing it.
The airplane is a safe airplane, has a tremendous safety record, and airplanes are meant to have fuel in them, whether you're on the ground or in the air. That's the way they operate.
Schmidt says the maintenance crew averaged 15 years of experience. An investigation team led by the Air Force will try to determine the cause of the explosion. For National Public Radio, this is Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
Scientists have shattered the record for producing nuclear fusion energy at the start of a series of experiments at Princeton University. Scientists hope that fusion could provide clean, abundant energy for the mid-21st century. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Scientists have produced 5.6 million watts of power in a series of fusion energy experiments that are still underway. In a chamber made of magnetic fields and shaped like a donut, they've combined two forms of hydrogen called deuterium and tritium. These atoms fuse to form helium, producing energy in the process. These experiments are the first that have ever used what is believed to be the optimal blend of fuels for a future fusion energy plant, and the results are provoking a great deal of excitement among physicists. However, the energy being produced in these experiments is still less than the amount of energy needed to kindle them, and scientists say that a practical fusion energy reactor is still decades away. Fusion energy is considered to be safer and cleaner than conventional nuclear fission, although it will probably be more expensive. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 11 points to close at a record 3,741. Declines led advances by a margin of nearly 11-8 in heavy trading. This is NPR. U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor will meet his counterparts from the world's top trading powers this weekend in an effort to overcome the obstacles to world trade reform. Cantor told reporters that he'll meet tomorrow with Sir Leon Britton, the top trade official of the European Union. They'll try to work out disputes over aircraft and entertainment subsidies. Any agreement that the two sides reach would then be presented to Japanese and Canadian trade ministers in the evening. Proponents of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade say it could add more than $200 billion a year to the world economy. The Anglo-French consortium that built the Channel Tunnel between France and Britain turned the project over today to the company that will operate it when it opens in May. Lynn Terry has more from Paris.
French officials celebrated completion of the tunnel with a brass band and the first train trip under the channel to Britain, which took about 30 minutes. The 30-mile tunnel is an old French dream. It was the most ambitious construction project of the century. It took 6 years to build at a cost of about $18 billion, almost twice the original estimate. It was supposed to open last June, but now it will begin operating in May. Officials expect it to carry 30 million passengers a year, but a majority of them could be French. According to polls, about 75% of Britons don't plan to use the tunnel. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
President Clinton said today that he's optimistic about the administration's continuing effort to get North Korea to allow inspection of its nuclear sites. The president told reporters that he's aggressively pursuing an arrangement that would allow inspectors full access to all of the communist country's nuclear facilities. North Korea has offered a proposal for partial inspections, but the American officials have described that as unacceptable. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charles Bush discovered who he was as an actor when he became a leading lady. He now writes and stars in gender-bending plays that are both tributes to and send-ups of Hollywood. His Vampire Lesbians of Sodom was the longest-running play in off-Broadway history. His Psycho Beach Party spoofed two Sally Field roles. He stars as a teenage girl who wants to be a surfer, but suffers from multiple personality disorder. The Lady in Question was a melodrama set in the 40s. New York Times critic Frank Rich described Bush's performance as a walking anthology of feminine Hollywood legends. Rich asked, but what actor of either gender could top Mr. Bush? Bush has a new semi-autobiographical novel called Whores of Lost Atlantis. Bush says he didn't find himself as an actor until he put on lashes and heels. When we spoke earlier this year, I wanted to know what dressing in drag brings out in him.
Well, what it initially brought out in me was a whole sense of freedom and expression that I didn't have. It was a rather liberating experience for me at first. I think things have sort of changed as I've kind of grown up, become maybe more comfortable with myself. But when I started out, I used to do a one-man show for years that I booked around the country called Charles Bush Alone with a Cast of Thousands. And at the time, I wasn't in drag. I would be just kind of in black pants and a shirt, and I played many different characters, and it would be kind of a narrative where I would have to play every character that, you know, that I needed in that particular story. And so often there'd be male roles that just weren't really right for me, and I didn't think I was really very good at, and I thought I was rather stiff. And somehow the female characters seemed the more fun. You know, often women can be more flamboyant, more expressive at times. So I enjoyed that. And then when I started performing with my theater company in the East Village in the 80s, I decided just to put on, you know, this outrageous drag outfit. We really thought it was just going to be for a weekend. Little did I know it would be my career. But it was a very liberating experience, and I wasn't, for the first time, I wasn't thinking about, oh, what do I do with my hands? It just, somehow, it came very natural. The interesting thing I find now, though, thousands of performances later and thousands of pairs of eyelashes later, that what was so liberating is beginning to feel a little confining, and I'm actually ready to de-drag for a while, to be a fella, because it just, after all this time, I've been doing it since 84, sometimes it feels a little bit just confining to have my creativity always filtered through this sort of female persona.
What do you think the difference is between what you're doing on stage and what more traditional female impersonators have done? The female impersonators who specialize in Betty Davis and Judy Garland, Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm.
Well, because they are doing specific people, and I do different characters that are sort of my own invention. Although sometimes I kind of
do a little Judy,
or if I'm doing, like, at one point in the show, I do this old movie sketch, and I kind of slip into a little Betty Davis at times just to kind of punctuate the line, or a little Susan Hayward. But it's basically my own character. I like to think.
But it also seems to me that you're more consciously gender bending than a lot of your predecessors.
Yeah. But I sort of straddle the fence in many ways. It seems that you can sort of divide female impersonators into two groups, generally those who are comedians and are pretty, you know, kind of outrageous looking and somewhat maybe even grotesque, but are very funny. And then there are other female impersonators who go to great lengths to create this perfect illusion of beautiful femininity. And often they kind of lip sync to songs or, you know, but I'm sort of in the middle because I'm a comedian, but I look kind of good in those gowns. My legs ain't bad, you know, so I think, you know, so I'm sort of in the middle. And I must say, too, I've lost any bit of integrity I may have had. Or I used to go to great pains where we would, when I would do shows, that I never wore falsies, that I wasn't really trying to convince the audience of an illusion. I was just kind of giving the notion of a general idea. But I don't know. Maybe it's just I've gotten older, but I'm so padded up. I think I've got two editions of the Sunday Times in each hip, you know. And, you know, my God, you know, I go to great pains now to look very lovely. So, you know, I'm very careful about the lighting. So I don't know what that is. Maybe it's just the more you do it, the more you kind of get into it.
You know, some drag queens object to feminism because it's not feminine enough. And really, some drag queens really believe in traditional gender roles.
Yeah, I would think so. Isn't it interesting? And yet, I guess, you know, I was raised in a largely female household with two sisters that I'm very close to. And so the issues of feminism have always been rather real to me. And so I have always kind of prided myself that the female characters in my plays are sort of feminist role models. I always sort of played the career woman, you know, battling that devil man who's you can't trust him. You know, so I've kind of liked it, and I, you know, I have. I seems like I have a female following. You know, I think there's, you know, always going to be somebody who's upset by something you do, and I'm sure, you know, some women might just find the whole notion of drag just offensive, and no matter what you do, you know, even if I did the Kate Millett story, they wouldn't like it, you know. But I, in my heart, I know that I respect women, and I love the kind of women that I admire, so are such strong women.
For our listeners who haven't seen your shows, let me ask you to say a couple of words about a couple of your shows.
Okay.
Let's start with Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. This
Those are your four big words. Strong words.
And, well, you know, not the of.
But we had, you know, a hard time, you know, when that show first started in 80, we started in 84, we moved it commercially in 85, and the New York Times wouldn't print the name in the ad.
Really?
And, yeah, and I wondered, I thought, you know, gee, it must be I think if the play was called The Lesbian, they would have printed it. If it was called Vampires, or even if it was called Sodom, but you put them together and, oh boy, you know, head for the hills.
So tell us what it was about.
Well, it was kind of like a series of vaudeville sketches more than a play. And I played a lovely virgin sacrifice in ancient Sodom who is bit by the very glamorous succubus creature, this kind of Mae Westian vampirist, and she, the virgin sacrifice, because of this bite, becomes a vampire too. And so the two of them are kind of in a race across time as they go through various centuries trying to steal each other's thunder. And kind of the joke of it was that they were both, after they left Sodom, they both were in show business. And so we saw them in Hollywood in the 20s where they were vamps and silent films, and then in Las Vegas today and they're still at it. So it was, you know, it was a cute show. And what I liked about it too is that underneath all the very silly campiness, it kind of, I thought it had a little something to say about relationships. And I think that many of us have friends or even, you know, relatives who could just drive us crazy and you'd like to murder at times. But if they weren't around, we'd certainly miss them.
Well, what was the very first time you dressed in drag?
Let's see. Well, I think when I was about 9, I think Bobby Fitzpatrick next door wanted us to put on his mother's evening gown. But other than that, it was many years later. I was in college and just dressing up for Halloween. But I learned really right away. It occurred to me that I got kind of bored when I just put on the dress and makeup and everything, got all rigged up. Just as an end to itself, it just, I got kind of restless and sort of tired too. You just kind of want to spread your legs and, you know, and relax, you know. And I needed to have the role. It's, for me, drag is so connected with the theater that I can't separate it. That as soon as I like for instance, we had a float in the gay parade this year, and I put together this outfit to I mixed and matched, and but this at this point I certainly can. I've got probably more clothes than you have. I mean, I've a lot of dresses for every occasion, you know, if you need
I'm
anything.
Sure you have more heels than I do.
Yeah, well, call me, you know. And anyway, so I put together this outfit to wear, just to wear, you know, in this open car. And as soon as I put it on, though, my mind was just racing so quickly. I was suddenly I was Melina McCrory in Never on Sunday. 5 seconds later, no, I'm Audrey Hepburn in a 60s caper film. Oh no! And it was so dizzying that I finally was just getting like hyperventilating just because of the images in my head of the different roles that I could play in that costume. So it wasn't enough just to be, you know, don't I look swell in this lovely couture creation.
You know, it's really funny. I feel like I should ask you for tips about how to walk in high heels. I've never been able to wear heels.
Really? It's so simple.
Not that I'm dying to wear them or anything, yeah, but no, my feet ache and I figure it's not worth it. So you want to give me some tips?
Oh, I could run the decathlon in it. I could. You know, talk about drag racing. I mean, I could really. I walk better in heels, I think, than in flats somehow. I've fallen arches, kind of. I think the heels help me. But I must say, after a number of hours, it's agony. I had this part in the sequel to The Addams Family, which is coming out in November, and I play their cousin, the Countess Aphasia Addams Du Barry, and I was in high heels for 17 hours, on a movie set, and that was rather horrifying, you know. But for a couple hours, I don't know, you just sort of balance yourself and. I took to it like a duck to water. You know, I never quite understood when you see movies like Tootsie where the guys get in heels and they're wobbling all over the place. And I know, I guess, you know, it's for comic effect, but I never found it so tricky.
Actor and writer Charles Bush is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charles Bush. He has a new semi-autobiographical novel called Whores of Lost Atlantis. Our interview was recorded earlier this year. Did dressing in drag or doing theater in drag coincide at all with figuring out your sexual identity?
In a certain sense, it did. In just that, when I was in college, I was coming out gay and I came out gay with a sledgehammer. I mean, I was just, you know, awful. You know, just outraged with my best friend and I. And we just, you know, it was sort of during the height of the David Bowie sort of, you know, glitter rock period. We had red hair and, you know, eyeliner on. And I had this awful big big fur coat on. I thought I looked like Maria Schneider in Les Tango of Paris. But I don't know if everyone else shared that opinion. But anyway, at the same time, I'm taking these acting classes. And the roles that you would work on in class would be like, you know, Bo and Bus Stop or Biff and Death of the Salesman, and I just did not identify at all. And there just were there are no roles to that are anything, you know. And particularly like in college, we would be in it was kind of a method sort of, you know, Stanislavski approach where you're supposed to be using elements of your own, you know, past and your emotions, and it was very hard for me to identify. And so, consequently, there were, like, no roles that I even wanted to play. And I was really tormented because I was obsessed with acting and all my life wanted to be an actor. And I thought, well, if there are no roles in the repertoire that I am desperate to play, what's the point, you know? And I thought, I could be the boy in Equus, but there are many other fellas who could play it a lot better or just as well. And I wanted to be special. I wanted to be unique. And I always wrote. And then I was always kind of improvising different characters for my friends. And I had a friend who said, well, this is who you are. This is what you should do. And it took me a while to really realize that was the case. And that what I really loved was writing the story and telling it myself. And for me, drag and assuming a female persona is not such a big deal. You know, I know there are great differences between the sexes, but in many ways there aren't. And at least for me, you know, I guess I have a slightly androgynous nature, and for me to go from male to female is sometimes just a question of how I cross my legs.
Can I quote something from the galleys of your forthcoming novel that mm-hmm. I've been reading? Mm-hmm. And the novel is called Whores of Lost Atlantis. It's a semi-autobiographical novel. And early on in the novel, the main character, who is very similar to you,
I should say so,
yes, says, on a cloudy day, I can't tell whether I'm adopting the mannerisms of an effeminate man or a hard-boiled lady.
Yeah, that's sort of it. Yeah, that book's very personal. It was an interesting thing when I began writing it about 3 years ago. It was going to be a very superficial kind of anti-mame sort of comedy book. And then the more I worked on it, and I realized that, you know, I was writing from the first person, and it was very much based on my experiences starting my theater company in the East Village in the 80s. I thought it was such a good opportunity for me to really explore, you know, my feelings about drag and androgyny and the creative process, and it was a very good experience for me, and so the book became much richer for it.
Now, your father, I understand, listened to a lot of opera, and did he sell opera records?
No, my father, well, he had a record store, it's true, and I guess he did sell some opera records, although I think of him mostly having, you know, rock and roll, but his store was in Yonkers, so it wasn't really an opera haven. But he wanted to be a singer, and so he performed with different sort of semi-professional and amateur opera companies in Westchester, where I was growing up. And so my bedtime stories were the plots of Verdi and Puccini operas, and sort of the first theater I saw were these productions that he would be in, where everything, including the chorus, were painted on the backdrop, and I just was enraptured by it. And I think that whole idea of sort of cheap theatricality stayed with me, and certainly you can see it in my plays.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the larger-than-life type of play.
Yeah, I love melodrama so much, and even as much as I love the comedy. And so my plays are often, you know, sort of revenge dramas, and if you took away the element of parody or the, you know, the shtick or the comedy, you know, the stories themselves are stories of passion and revenge and, you know, good triumphing, and there's often, you know, somebody either jumps out a window or is being murdered. I think somebody's been murdered in just about every play I've written. It's kind of odd, you know, and they're comedies. So I think that really shows that earliest interest was in melodrama.
So while your father was feeding you these stories of the great operas and thus kind of nourishing your interest in
melodrama... I had a very
melodrama.
Romantic sensibility that was... By the time I'd say I was seven, my entire... Everything that I'm interested in today was set.
But I bet your father was not very encouraging of your interest in acting out the parts of great actresses.
Oh, yeah, pas nécessaire.
No,
my father was so stage struck.
Oh, really?
So stage struck that I really could have done anything and he would have been approved. And I mean, just I think when he sees my name on a marquee, I think he considered blot out the first name and imagine it's his own. I mean, he kind of lives vicariously through me, and I don't mind it at all, you know. So he lives in Florida now, but when he comes to see me in a show and, you know, I bring him backstage and he walks out on the stage, I can see him just sort of inhaling it in. He just loves it. And so he's seen all my shows, and that doesn't bother him at all.
Charles Bush recorded earlier this year. His new novel is called Whores of Lost Atlantis. He's now in rehearsal for a new production of the musical Little Me in Birmingham, Michigan. According to columnist Liz Smith, the role was first offered to Debbie Reynolds, but when she couldn't be pinned down, the director suggested Charles Bush. You can now see Bush in a cameo in Addams Family Values in the role of Countess Aphasia. We'll meet the screenwriter of Addams Family Values in the second part of our show. Sunday night, you can watch a new and complete production of Gypsy on CBS. Bette Midler stars in the role that was written for Ethel Merman. Gypsy was first staged in 1959. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of the new production.
It turns out there's a major production of Gypsy on some medium once a decade. In the 50s, everything in the musical was designed around what Ethel Merman could or couldn't do. Jewel Stein wrote the music to suit her range. Stephen Sondheim provided her with the show's most dramatic lyrics. And Jerome Robbins made sure that other cast members handled the choreography. In the 60s, Rosalind Russell starred in the movie version and was flat-out awful. In the 70s, Angela Lansbury played Mama Rose in a revival of Gypsy on Broadway and won a Tony. So did Tyne Daly when she revived the role in the 80s. And now it's the 90s, and it's only because this Gypsy is on television that Bette Midler won't get her Tony. But somewhere out there, I bet, is an Emmy with her name on it.
I had a dream about you, baby. It's gonna come true, baby. They think that we're through, but baby, you'll be swell, you'll be great.
We all know Midler can belt the hell out of the showstoppers. That's been her specialty all of her career. We also know she can sing emotionally and powerfully without cranking up the volume. All you have to do is think of her farewell song to Johnny Carson to know how true that is. But one thing that's so surprising about her performance as Mama Rose, the quintessential stage mother, is how much comedy and drama she pulls from the part when she's not singing. From the way she talks and moves, she gets laughs where there aren't any. And when she's protecting her children or her status quo, she's not just fierce, she's raw and vulnerable. In this scene, she attacks the secretary of a Broadway producer who wants to separate Rose's older daughter from the rest of the act. Peter Riegert plays Rose's lover and partner, Andrea Martin plays the secretary, and Rose, of course, is pure Bette Midler.
Oh, they're so smart, New York.
New York is a center of...
New York is a center of New York! There's a whole country full of people, who know what a mother means to her daughter. It's hicks like you that don't know. And I'll tell you something else. Grant Sinker's a hick. He'll get no place.
Rose.
He's trying to take my baby away from me. That's what he's trying to do. Well, over my dead body he will.
The other star of this show is Cynthia Gibb, who plays Louise, the younger daughter who grows up to be Gypsy Rose Lee. For someone who starred in the Karen Carpenter story just a few years ago, it's quite a change of pace. And Emil Ardolino, who directed this version before dying of AIDS last month, was determined to present the true Gypsy. Every word is here, every song, and the TV show even opens with the full overture. There's no attempt to update it, which is smart. Not only is it a really strong and faithful rendition of Gypsy, but the striptease sequences are tame enough for TV and for the whole family. And the best thing of all is that most of the songs were recorded on the sound stages as the scenes were filmed. So instead of looking like a badly lip-synced MTV video, Gypsy looks real as a musical can get anyway. This CBS version of Gypsy has the smell of a hit, and if it does hit, more musical remakes are bound to follow, which is something network TV should have been doing a long time ago. So gather up the kids or your friends and watch Gypsy this Sunday. Let it entertain you. And with Midler in the leading role, it will.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Let me entertain you. Let me make you smile.
Sing out, Louise!
Let me do a few tricks, some old and then some new tricks. I'm very versatile. And if you're real good, I'll make you feel good. I want your spirits to climb. So let me entertain you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, what's so funny about love and sex in the age of AIDS? We talk with playwright Paul Rudnick about his off-Broadway comedy, Jeffrey, about a man who swears off love and sex and then meets the man of his dreams. Rudnick also wrote the screenplay for Adam's Family Values. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Western, Geronimo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Clinton met with AFL-CIO President Lane Kirkland today in an effort to mend the hard feelings left from the NAFTA fight. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Kirkland left the White House after the meeting with the president without speaking to reporters. But White House Press Secretary Dee Dee Myers characterized the meeting as frank, friendly, and productive. Words usually used when difficult issues are discussed. The AFL and the White House clashed bitterly during the fight over the North American Free Trade Agreement when the president accused labor of muscle-bound, roughshod lobbying tactics and Lane Kirkland accused the president of abdicating leadership of the Democratic Party. During the NAFTA fight, several unions promised to withhold campaign funds from Congress members who voted for NAFTA, and labor has been withholding campaign contributions from Democratic Party campaign funds until February. White House officials say they expect the wounds between the White House and one of its most important allies to heal as the administration and labor work together on issues such as health care reform, the striker replacement bill, and reform of the worker safety laws. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher has confirmed that PLO leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin will meet Sunday in an attempt to push forward plans for Palestinian self-rule in the occupied territories. Christopher was speaking after meeting with Arafat at PLO headquarters in Tunis. Alfred Hermida reports.
Secretary Christopher came to Tunis on the final leg of a Middle East tour, which took him to Israel, Jordan, and Syria. On the agenda during his talks with PLO leader Arafat was the agreement for Palestinian self-rule in the Gaza Strip and Jericho. The accord is due to come into effect on Monday with the start of an Israeli army withdrawal. But the pullout could be delayed as the two sides have failed to reach agreement on key issues, such as the extent of the withdrawal. After an hour-long meeting with Arafat at PLO headquarters, Christopher confirmed that the PLO leader would meet Israeli Prime Minister Rabin in Cairo on Sunday. The summit meeting will be the last chance the two sides have to resolve their differences before Monday's deadline. For National Public Radio, this is Alfred Hermida in Tunis.
Analysts say falling international oil prices are holding inflation in check, despite the improvement in the American economy. The government reports inflation for November at 0.2 points, due mainly to a drop of 1.3% in energy prices. That's their biggest drop since March 1991. Prices at the consumer level were up 2.8% for the first 11 months of the year. That's close to the rate for all of last year, 2.9%. Analysts say lower energy prices are good for the American economy because they give consumers and businesses money to spend on other goods and services. Analysts expect oil prices to stay low enough to keep inflation at near zero for a few months. This is NPR News. The State Department has warned Americans to leave Algeria because of terrorist violence against foreigners. Islamic extremists have been fighting the secular government for power. The State Department says foreigners are being actively targeted for politically motivated violence. And political violence has erupted in the capital of the Central African nation of Gabon today after the re-election of the country's longtime ruler was announced. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Opposition protesters set up barricades and clashed with security forces in Gabon's capital of Libreville. The riots are apparently triggered by the announcement that President Omar Bongo has been re-elected in the country's first multi-party elections. Bongo, who seized power in a military coup 26 years ago, was declared the election winner over Catholic priest Paul Mba Abasole by a 2-1 margin. However, Abasole's supporters are claiming widespread fraud. Meanwhile, Gabonese authorities said that the current political unrest appears to be spreading from opposition strongholds in the capital's slums to the city center, but so far there are no reports of injuries or damage. The violence comes despite government appeals for calm and the placing of the oil-rich country's army on full alert. International election observers who monitored the balloting on Sunday were warned to remain indoors. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Fighting is heating up again in Sarajevo and other parts of Bosnia, and international mediators have called for a new round of peace talks in Geneva later this month. UN aid officials say they're halting fuel deliveries to Bosnian Serbs. The officials accuse Serbs in Bosnia and Serbia of blocking two convoys headed for Muslim enclaves. A UN spokeswoman says the Serbs are breaking agreements they've made to allow aid convoys to move freely through Bosnia. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 11 points to close at a new record high, 3740.67. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Writer Paul Rudnick is becoming famous for his offbeat humor. He wrote the screenplay for Adam's Family Values. His off-Broadway hit, Jeffrey, is the only play I can think of that opens with a condom breaking. Jeffrey is a comedy about love and sex in the age of AIDS. New York Times theater critic Frank Rich described it as the funniest play of this season and maybe last season, too. Rudnick also wrote the hit Broadway comedy I Hate Hamlet. Sister Act evolved from one of his screenplays. He asked that his name be removed from the film for reasons he'll explain to us later. Rudnick's comic novel, I'll Take That, was about a family of compulsive shoppers. Of course, it's easier to find humor in a shopping spree than in the AIDS epidemic. When we spoke last April, Rudnick told me he thinks of humor as a weapon against AIDS.
When people come see the play, they're sort of not quite sure what to expect, especially when they hear that it's a comedy about AIDS. They all wonder, how is that possible? And throughout the play, there's sort of a roller coaster effect, because the play doesn't shy away from the subject matter, from AIDS and from that particular nightmare. And there are these moments when the audience will gasp or suddenly become very, very quiet. And they'll feel, oh, my God, it's not a comedy anymore. You know, we won't be allowed to laugh after this. And then 5 seconds later, they're howling. And that's just, it's such a thrill for me as a writer and as a person to see that that works and that it's possible.
You know the saying that when you go to bed with someone, you're going to bed with everybody that person has ever slept with. You do that in a pretty comic way in the opening of your play. Would you describe it?
Oh, yes. Well, what I wanted the opening to be, it opens with two men in bed and they're having sex. And then one by one, the rest of the cast pop out of the bed, and suddenly you have eight people. And I based it on the idea of a clown car at the circus, where suddenly, you know, it seems like a tiny little vehicle, and suddenly the stage is packed. And the audience, you could see at the beginning, they get a little nervous because they worry when you open a play with two people having sex, sort of, where do you go from there? What are we in for? And then as everyone starts appearing, they start to laugh, and they start to just realize, okay, we're not sure what we're in for, but it seems like a good time. So, I love that kind of opening because it just really, it's the exact right image for the play, the kind of lunacy of sex, period, and certainly of sex nowadays.
You know, in talking about allowing yourself to see a comic side to the epidemic, it reminds me of an op-ed piece you wrote in the New York Times about visiting a friend in the hospital. And your friend had AIDS, and you say that he wasn't a suitably noble dying person. He wasn't only dying, he was whining. And he wouldn't even wear his new silk robe because it was too George Hamilton. How did this experience change you?
Oh, well, that was when this guy who he was dying, and he was horribly obnoxious, which I feel terrible saying that, but someone who's sick and is no longer with us. But all of his friends and myself, we kept visiting and we're really trying to be supportive. And he was treating us the way a rude celebrity would treat a waiter. And even though you don't want to ever desert someone at a point like that, we finally all met in the lobby of St. Vincent's Hospital in front of a bad oil painting of the Pope and collapsed in laughter because that was all that was left. It was just, if we were going to go back up there and be handmaidens to the dying emperor, there was very little choice other than to find it amusing. And it's funny, I have a friend right now, actually, who is quite ill, although on the mend in Florida, and I've been talking to him on the phone, and it reminded me of that situation, except he actually is quite a spectacularly humorous person, and he had just been through a terrible episode of illness, of a viral thing attacking his spine, all sorts of dreadful things. But meanwhile, and his speech was a little slurred. But while I was talking to him, he said, with a little slur, he said, "I know I sound like post-stroke Betty Davis." And then he said, "I hate this hospital. Everywhere I turn, there are crazed candy stripers and Shanghai shame girls." And I wasn't even quite sure what he was talking about, but he seemed in a good mood, and it was his personality coming through the disease. And somehow that seemed a triumph of sorts, and that's what Jeffrey's all about, too, is that kind of victory through personality and humor.
You know, Jeffrey, your main character, says at one point, "I hate sex, I hate love, I hate the world for giving me everything and then taking it back." Have you watched people go through different phases in their attitude about sex and love during the epidemic?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it was why when I first had the idea for the play, the situation of someone giving up sex because of AIDS and because of the last 10 years seemed the romantic situation of our time. And that if you were going to write a play that is in many ways a romantic comedy, that was the dilemma that everyone is in right now. And at that point in the play, Jeffrey, the leading character, has made this vow to give up sex and then met the man of his dreams, this fantastic guy who is also HIV positive. So suddenly I can't imagine being more torn between feelings of overwhelming romantic love and what are you letting yourself in for in terms of someone being sick, in terms of someone who you may then need to be taking quite a bit of care of, and just the idea of falling in love with someone who may very well not live forever. And that's the moment that Jeffrey reaches sort of towards the end of the first act when he just throws up his hands and says, "These are all the things I love, and they are suddenly seem forbidden. And where's the nearest bridge?" And I think the play is about avoiding the nearest bridge.
Now, we were talking about funerals before. Have you spoken at many funerals?
Let me think. I've spoken sort of as one of a group of friends.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been the main act. I've never been the floor show. Also, because in New York, especially in the theatrical community where they have memorials on the stage of Broadway theaters, it's like, I'm not going to compete with Jennifer Holliday and Patti LuPone. You know, when you've got name entertainment, I think, no, I mean, I'd have to bring out white tigers or something in order to compete. So it's that's what gets also funny is you start to feel, oh, I don't know, like tickets will be available half price at the booth sometimes for these these events. But I have spoken at them, and it's, I guess, the nicest ones and the most memorable memorials are the most personal. There was one, actually, it was funny. It wasn't for a man who died of AIDS. It was for a man who died of cancer, which, it's funny, there used to be a scene in the play that it's really pushes the boundaries of taste, but everyone I know identified with it, which was when you hear about someone who didn't die of AIDS, where they have a heart attack or brain tumor, you somehow oddly think, good for them. You think, what a horrible response because they're still dead. But on the other hand, it seems oddly refreshing. I remember when Andy Warhol died and people realized it wasn't AIDS, there was this feeling of that was how original. And I think it's just because death has become so much more commonplace than anyone expected, especially at people at younger ages, that suddenly you're forced into these sort of bizarre responses.
My guest is Paul Rudnick. He wrote the screenplay for Addams Family Values and the off-Broadway comedy Jeffrey. Our interview was recorded last April. More with Rudnick after this break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Paul Rudnick is my guest. In your previous play, I Hate Hamlet, which is about a TV actor who's about to play Hamlet, and the actor is met by the ghost of John Barrymore, who, of course, informs him how to perform. So in the part of the ghost of John Barrymore was Nicole Williamson.
God love him.
Well, tell us what happened the night that his co-star, Evan Handler, the actor who played the TV actor in your show, the night that Evan Handler walked out in the middle of the performance.
Yes. Well, no, Evan, it must be said, was a saint. Evan had, this was all tip of the iceberg time. Evan, during rehearsals, had put up with an enormous amount of dreadful misbehavior on the part of Nicole Williamson, and this was the night it finally peaked. And the first act of that play ended with a climactic stage duel with swords. And Nicole Williamson, who is a, oh, egomaniac is far too kind a word. I think you would have to, any word that ends in maniac will do for Nicole. But he began to direct Evan while on stage, and this all sort of culminated in Nicole actually stabbing him and drawing blood. And Evan quite wisely left the stage at that point and the production and the theater. So it was the understudy finished the second act and the rest of the run of the play. And the next morning when I came downstairs to get a magazine at my newsstand, there was a picture from the play that filled the entire front page of the New York Post with the headline, "Star Swats Actor on the Butt." And that kind of phraseology, I think, may explain the troubles that the Post is having right now. But it was a story that then the media just adored. And for weeks thereafter, there were TV crews at the theater. I was getting calls from all over the world. I sort of learned to say no comment in every language. And it seemed to be somehow you could either hear Barrymore up in heaven, you know, cackling gleefully or snickering with vengeance. But it was a very wild time.
Were you in the theater that night?
No, I wasn't. And I'm grateful I wasn't. Many people were there. Even now people come up to me saying I was there as if it were Woodstock. And Gregory Peck was there that night, and Elaine Stritch. I was seeing something else. I ran into the show's press agent later that night who told me that the story was going to appear on the front page of the Times, but that Jerzy Kosinski, the Polish author, had committed suicide that night and had bumped I Hate Hamlet back to the art section. And even though I did not wish Jerzy Kosinski any ill, I began just laughing uncontrollably, and I was so glad he picked that night because I thought, no, I didn't need this on the front page. But so it just had all these sort of absurd dimensions to it.
Isn't it good publicity, though, to have something really wild happen on stage?
It certainly was a lot of publicity. And I think because the play was a comedy and involved a wild figure like Barrymore, it didn't really hurt the play. It sort of fed into it. On the other hand, I felt after that evening, audiences came with real bloodlust, kind of the Roman Colosseum feeling, and were terribly disappointed when no one was stabbed. And I thought, you know, I'm sorry we'd run out of actors.
Now, I know that you wrote the original version of the movie that became Sister Act, and then you eventually had your name taken off of it, and I think a lot of script doctors rewrote it. What was the difference between your conception and the movie?
Well, the original script, which I was quite fond of, was written very much as a vehicle for Bette Midler, mm-hmm. and to take advantage of her genius. And I wanted it to be quite subversive. It had the same overall plot, which was that of a kind of broken-down chorus girl who, for various reasons, is forced to join a convent for a brief period of time. But I think kind of the best way to put it is what was intended to be a satire of the singing nun became the singing nun. I wanted to show the triumph of a certain kind of pure show business glee over the Catholic Church, or at least the more repressive aspects of the Catholic Church, because although there are certainly positive, if not miraculous, aspects to most religions, there are also a darker side. And I wanted to show kind of Bette Midler gleefully victorious. And as the rewrites continued, and then when Bette was replaced in the role with Whoopi Goldberg, there were just demands made that I was in violent disagreement with. The movie became much more a case of sort of wholesome uplift and also just not funny, so that I eventually had no choice but to leave the project. And then I left about 2 months before filming began, and it was rewritten by at least five other people, so that the result was very far from my intention. The movie was very successful anyway, so sort of what do I know? But it just was odd.
When you started writing, were there many out writers, you know, gays who were out, like yourself?
Yes. I think, you know, increasingly, certainly more and more, that there the other night I did a wonderful benefit reading for ACT UP, at which there were practically more gay novelists reading than there were people in attendance, and there was a big crowd. But it's been wonderful. I think one of the great pluses of having so many gay writers is that no one writer has to carry that burden of representing all gay people forever.
Well, what about the differences between being out in Hollywood and on Broadway?
Well, I think in the theater, I mean, both sectors certainly have an enormous amount of gay people working in them. The theater has certainly been far more in the vanguard of gay subject matter, you know, both in AIDS plays in terms of The Normal Heart and As Is and terrific works like that. But just even in terms of real commercial theater, a wonderful show like Falsettos, which, you know, very much has many, many gay characters and is a smash hit on Broadway and is a musical, that just Broadway and wonderfully, I think, the theater audience has been so much more accepting, in fact, eager to hear all sorts of stories. And I think in Hollywood, there's a real fear of gay subject matter and a fear that it's not commercial, a fear that it's off-putting, which I think as time goes by will, God willing, be completely erased, because I think it just leads to so many awful decisions that every gay movie somehow then has to be very serious and it just has to be an ultimate statement. And you think, of course, this could often end up being quite boring films because you sense all of this, you know, earnest hand-wringing going on behind them. So I think Hollywood just, you know, has to get over itself. And as it has with black films, films about women, films about all the groups that weren't considered commercial until suddenly you had a smash hit. But Hollywood lives in fear in general. You know, Hollywood is run not just on racism and homophobia, but on fear of studio executives losing their job if they produce the wrong Police Academy 8. So to try and get them to, you know, open up to in terms of subject matter is not easy.
Paul Rudnick wrote the screenplay for Adam's Family Values. His comedy, Jeffrey, runs through mid-January at the Minetta Lane Theater in Manhattan. Our interview was recorded last April. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. Today the subjects include fusion, the Russian election, the Chilean election, how the Palestinians are preparing for autonomy in Gaza and Jericho. Deborah Amos reports on how they're likely and how they're starting now to organize health services once the autonomy agreement takes effect. And also we'll be hearing about inflation in Yugoslavia, where the National Bank of Yugoslavia is now producing 5 billion dinar notes. They're worth under $10.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Since his directorial debut in 1975 with the Charles Bronson movie Hard Times, Walter Hill has racked up an impressive assortment of action films, including The Warriors, Streets of Fire, 48 Hours, and last year's Trespass. But he's only made one Western, the 1980 film The Long Riders. Now Hill returns to the Old West with Geronimo, an American legend. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
If those huge red rock formations and sage-salted dunes look familiar, that's because we've been here before, with dozens of Western movie makers since the golden age of John Ford. The scene is the area around Moab, Utah, and the setting looks familiar in other ways, too. There's the 6th Cavalry dressed in blue, for instance, and there are the Apaches eyeing them warily from a distant mesa. So what new changes will Walter Hill ring on the old themes? The answer comes as a bit of a surprise. He makes them boring. How can you go so wrong with a story as thrilling as Geronimo's? He was, after all, the last Apache leader to surrender to the white men who had invaded and confiscated Indian lands. The movie begins as Geronimo turns himself in to Lieutenant Charles Gatewood, played by Jason Patrick. He brings Geronimo back to the fort to confront Geronimo's old enemy, General George Crook, played by Gene Hackman. Crook is willing to make a deal with Geronimo. He'll let him go in peace as long as Geronimo and his tribe confine themselves to the Turkey Creek Reservation, where they'll give up the gun and farm corn. That arrangement works for a few months, but then an Apache medicine man, a dreamer, as the Indians call him, is murdered by the cavalry, and Geronimo and his band go on the warpath again. About midway through the hostilities, Geronimo meets with General Crook, and General Crook gives him a piece of his mind.
I knew Cochise. He was a king. He was a wise ruler of his people. I knew Vittorio. He was a proud leader. And I know Geronimo, who doesn't want to lead or rule or be wise. He just wants to fight.
I didn't start this trouble. The army killed the dreamer.
He was calling for war. If the medicine man had come in peaceably, he'd be alive. There's no excuse for taking up arms against the United States Army. The Army is the best friend that Chiricahua ever had. You know it, and I know it.
With all this land, why is there no room for the Apache? Why does the White Eye want all land?
That's Wes Studi as Geronimo. You may remember him as the perfidious Magua in The Last of the Mohicans. Here he spends most of his time looking ferocious and talking very, very slowly. In fact, everybody in this movie talks very, very slowly, and what they say is very, very predictable. It's all about how the White Eyes are unjust, and the Apache are a proud nation. And every now and then, Jason Patrick will step in to say, in his fake Virginia accent, "We're trying to make a country here. It's hard." Whenever the rhetoric lets up, Walter Hill directs his action scenes pretty well. He's especially good at making horses gallop at top speed from a standing start, and then stop on a dime. But the action scenes are relatively few, and the characters are so bland and stereotypical that they never draw us in. The whole movie seems to be happening very far away. It's as though you were watching it through a glaze that's two parts political correctness and one part weird lighting effects. There is a fascinating film to be made about Geronimo, not only about his war against the U.S. Army, but about his life in captivity, about his attempt to join the Dutch Reformed Church, from which he was expelled because he couldn't resist gambling, and about the way he cultivated his own legend. The real Geronimo lived to the age of 79. In this movie, he never comes to life at all.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Our senior producer this week was Fred Landerl. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease. Our theme music was composed by the Microscopic Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester, performed by the Microscopic Septet. That's them you're listening to now. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What are the new economic rules of international trade? How is America repositioning itself? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with James Fallows, Washington editor for The Atlantic, NPR commentator, and author of a forthcoming book about Japan. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.